Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, live from the Tobey Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club of California, it's Week to Week, the political roundtable for Monday, November 13th, 2017. Welcome, everybody. We will, of course, discuss these surprising turn of events in the Alabama Senate race, in which Republican Roy Moore has been accused by, I believe it's now five women, of pursuing underage women for sex. The harsh criticism of Moore led Alabama's state auditor, Jim Ziegler, to defend him by saying, and this is a quote, "Take Joseph and Mary. Mary was a teenager, and Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became parents of Jesus. There's just nothing immoral or illegal here, maybe just a little bit unusual," unquote. An actual quote. Now, of course, Mr. Ziegler seems a little unclear about the fact that pretty much all we know about Mary and Joseph is that they didn't have sex. That's kind of what the religion is based upon. But hey, he had to give a quote, and so he did. I'm John Zipper. I'm your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to discuss the recent elections across the state, the country, California's own closely watched upcoming senatorial and gubernatorial races, sexual harassment in state houses. We'll discuss all of that and more, Roy Moore. And of course, we'll end the evening with our news quiz. As always, I know that the Commonwealth Club is a place with for people with a wide variety of views. So any opinions expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end there with Dan Borenstein, who, since he last joined us, has a new job. He's now the editorial page editor of the East Bay Times, and he's on Twitter at BorensteinDan. Next to him is Carla Marinucci, senior writer of the Politico California Playbook, and she's on Twitter, at C. Marinucci. So welcome, Carla.
Thank you.
And next to me is Carson Bruno. He's the Assistant Dean for Admission and Program Relations at the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University, also the author of the California Realpolitik newsletter. He's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. So welcome. There are, of course, question cards throughout the room. Submit some questions. We'll have someone pick them up and deliver them to me, and I will try to ask as many as possible. On to our roundtable. Now, last week, Democrats celebrated a string of election victories across the country, their first taste of success, really, after the Republican victories of November 2016. Carla, I want to start with you. Was this the election so many Democrats needed, if you will, after last year's?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was something to celebrate. The Democrats haven't had a lot to celebrate since at least 2012, so this was a big one. And there was a couple of different things about it that were important for the Democrats. One, of course, the two governorships. One was sort of kicking Chris Christie out the door in New Jersey. But in Virginia, this was important because Ed Gillespie really ran on this a Trump agenda. It was very clear. We saw women come out. We saw millennials come out. We saw African-American voters come out. The real energized, the Obama coalition was back. And that was really important in Virginia. And I think we also saw some diverse candidates, including there in Virginia, a transgender candidate who defeated the legislator, a 28-year legislator who had authored the transgender bathroom bill. That was a big moment. And you had those kind of diverse elections going on across the country, where you had a number of African-American mayors elected, first-time women, other transgender candidates. In other words, the complexion of that election was interesting. And in Washington here, I think a very interesting thing was the cementing of the big blue wall with the...
Explain what that is.
Now, all three western states, Washington, Oregon, and California, are completely Democratic-dominated with the election of Manka Dinka to the state Senate in Washington. That was a final nail in the wall. And I think that's significant, too. That was another reason why Tuesday's elections were, for a lot of Democrats, the organizational moment they'd waited for. Tom Steyer put $3 million into organizing in Virginia. and has now committed now to upping his the amount of money he's doing, organizing going toward 2018, and doubling the amount of money he's spending on ads with regard to impeaching President Trump. And if you haven't seen those ads and you're just not watching TV, they are everywhere. So for all those reasons,
but Carla,
interesting.
To play devil's advocate for a second, though, where did they show, though, that they can win in those key swing states that they need to win, and key swing districts in any meaningful way? Washington, no surprise.
Yeah.
Virginia voted Hillary, right?
Yeah.
I mean, New Jersey, you know,
Christie
was an anomaly there, right?
Isn't there
a danger of making too much of this?
No, I totally agree with you, and I think this Democrats, if you talk to them after this, they're saying, look, they can't sit back and just hope everything's going to be great. It's the power of the get out the vote organizations that mattered here. I think a lot of the polls showed Gillespie winning in Virginia. Even when you looked at some of those, some of the cable shows, most of the pundits thought he was going to win. So it was a little bit of a surprise that Ralph.
So they avoided a disaster, is what it means.
They avoided disaster.
I mean, I hate to be the sort of the you know, doom and gloom for the Democrats, so to speak, perspective, but I'm not convinced that this is a little bit of a chip.
And that's right.
It's not this great revelation that they've suddenly turned the table.
Yeah, I think Dan's right in this. You know, we have to start out by saying this is one election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is one election, and most of those results, if they had gone the other way, would have been devastating. They should have won them all.
Yeah,
I think what it does do is reinforce the 2016 election, the trends that we saw in the aftermath. When you did the analysis of 2016, you did see that, particularly in Virginia, where Ed Gillespie got more votes than any Republican nominee for governor ever got. So it wasn't like the Republicans weren't really coming out, the Trump voters weren't really coming out. Mm-hmm. They came out and voted for him. And what happened, though, was we saw what happened for Hillary Clinton in 2016 in the state of Virginia, where the suburbs, the exurbs even, really came out and voted for the Democrats. 15 of the seats that flipped to the House of Delegates from Republican to Democrat, those were all Hillary Clinton seats. So that should concern all those other Republicans who are sitting in Hillary Clinton seats, that this trend may continue for them. It's still a little bit too early to tell if this is a full-blown wave or if this is kind of isolated just to those places like Virginia, which are very heavily influenced by the D.C. culture, D.C. life.
And some folks have said that we're also seeing Virginia turning blue. I mean, this is a continuation of a process that's been going on. Do you agree, Carson? I mean, that also was just another factor of it. Those suburbs were not just increasingly blue for this election, but that it's part of an ongoing thing.
You've been seeing it for quite some time. I mean, yes, George W. Bush won in 2000. He won it by a narrower amount in 2004. Then it flips to Barack Obama in 2008. Looked kind of close there, right, you know, after Barack Obama with Bob McDonald's election in 2009. But then it really has started to shift back to kind of this norm. And it makes sense when you look at kind of where the population centers are. They're increasingly becoming part of NOVA, the Northern Virginia region, which is an extension of the Washington, D.C. Media zone and kind of mentality. And the kind of the southwestern portions of Virginia are either becoming less populated, or even if they're becoming more heavily Republican, they're not as populated, which is hard then for to counteract the NOVA. It's similar to what we see kind of in California.
California situation turned on its side.
Exactly, yeah. Where inland California, I mean, it's deep red. I mean, it really is when you go into the inland portions of California, but there's not enough people there to really kind of make up those margins that you have along the coast.
I think in Virginia that one of the critical things to watch, and Democrats were sort of heartened about, is Ed Gillespie's defeat. And here is a mainstream Republican who really went hard right and with a message that was very, very harsh with regard to crime, immigration, and so forth. And I think the measure was going to be, is this the message that's going to sell in 2018? And it looks like it did not sell.
And
especially to those suburban voters that are going to matter so much.
And unfortunately, it doesn't seem that the National Republicans, at least kind of the Trump wing of the National Republicans, have gotten that message. They think it's because Ed Gillespie wasn't a true believer, so he wasn't really coming across as authentic as you know, Trump had, or you know, some of these other candidates could have or been. And so that's their takeaway. Well, if it had been Corey Stewart, don't worry, we would have this in the bag.
Yeah, but the Democrats have that same little bickering going on,
absolutely,
if you will.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, with the Bernie Sanders faction saying the problem with Hillary was she didn't go far enough left.
Well, I'd like to go into that a bit. I mean, you've all seen the stories lately about Donna Brazile, the former, I guess, really interim chair of the Democratic National Committee, came out with a book. In fact, spoke last week at the Commonwealth Club, but really earned a lot of attention with a few comments or claims she had made about the party, undue influence over the party by the Clinton campaign before the nomination, among other things. Dan, do you think last week's results put a damper on some of that civil war in the party, or it's just going to roll on?
I don't think that civil war is in any way going to dampen from what I can tell. But, you know, I mean, we'll find out as we start to really start seeing how they decide to organize. You know, there's a difference between a congressional year, if you will, and a presidential year. Because with a congressional year, you really, if you're going to be smart, run smart, you have to run each district with the candidate who's going to work in that district. You know, you can run a Barbara Lee in the East Bay, but you can't run a Barbara Lee in almost any other Democratic district in the country, if you will, without, you know, that's at all close. You know, so 2012 is not, probably won't have quite the internecine warfare come 2018, I'm sorry. Come 2020, that's another thing. I think, you know, unless somebody emerges out of the base of the party in a meaningful way, and somehow stands out, another Barack Obama, somebody who both sides can agree, wow, this is somebody who can really lead by personality and political nature. Unless that person steps forward, I don't see that those fissures going away at all.
Because, I mean, exactly right, Dan. Yeah. I mean, congressional races are about building coalitions to create majorities to get legislation passed, theoretically. That's what they're supposed to be about. Presidential races are about the soul of that particular party. You are essentially nominating someone to be the head of your party for potentially 8 years, hopefully, is what each party wants. And so it's a fight for what the soul of the party is versus the congressional races really is all about just getting to that magic number of really being able to manage a winning majority to get your agenda passed.
Someone in the audience asks, when will the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, start speaking to the downtrodden middle class about jobs? I mean, that's the kind of the core of the
well, and I think this is one of the problems that the DNC has. They put out a new agenda called a Better Deal. Yeah. I don't think
now, there's a catchy slogan.
I don't think any Democrat I've talked to, both elected or just grassroots, likes this plan, whatever it really is. I've heard Pelosi talk about it here in events. It's about jobs, but it's about getting rid of big monopolies, including like Amazon. And it's like, wait a minute, a lot of people like Amazon. It gets stuff to your house. You know, it's got a good return policy. What am I going to against Amazon? It's unclear what a better deal is. I don't think anybody likes the plan the way Democrats are selling it.
But here's the
thing. They haven't really verbalized.
But this really goes to, if you will, almost the irrelevancy of the parties in terms of message. Mm-hmm. They're very important organizing tools. But it's still, you know, this is what we've said when you and I have been here before. It still comes down to the candidates. Not only their policies, but them as people. With their ability not only to convey their message, but to convey some trust. That is what brought us you know, brought the Democrats Clinton. That is what brought them, you know, Bill Clinton in 92. Mm-hmm. That is what brought them Obama. You know, is a personality, a big personality. And what the DNC slogan is, I just don't think it matters.
The DNC and the RNC, for that matter, they're get out the vote operations. They're supposed to be the boots on the ground.
Right.
They're not the messengers. How long did we talk about the Republicans' growth and opportunity and prosperity message? Their whole kind of whatever you want to call it of the 2012 election. We talked about it for a month or two, and then it kind of went away because none of the candidates really cared about it.
But it does go back to what Dan is saying too, in the sense of it is about a personality and who is going to energize and you know, spark the imagination of voters. Today, The Guardian came out with a list of 20 Democratic candidates for 2020, and Jerry Brown's on that list. And it's like, and you know, in a way, you can kind of understand why. He's just so different from everything else that's out there. He's just like, tell it like it is. He's over there in Europe, you know, quoting Virgil and doing his thing. And the Europeans love him. And I think he's kind of refreshing in the sense of, no spin. He's got no entourage. You know, he's just.
He's been called the anti-Trump, though. That's
he's being called the anti-Trump
thing
and,
too.
And more than ever. In fact, our David Siders, my colleague at Politico, just wrote a story at Politico magazine on him. I urge you to check it out online. Jerry Brown is really the head of state, the head of a nation state, and he is the anti-Trump head of the nation state. I mean, going around the world and doing what he's doing. So I think the question is, Jerry Brown is 79. You know, is he really going to – the other names, a lot of the other names on the Democratic list are, you know, Joe Biden. What is he, 72? You know, I have heard, though – I was telling Carson this, some leading Republicans I was talking to down at Hoover Institution, conservative place, saying, look, if it's Biden running against Trump, I'm going with Biden. I mean, you know, that's when you look at his demeanor and the way he talks compared to what I think what we heard out of the president in Asia, you know, we'll see.
And we'll get to that. Someone in the audience asks, will gerrymandering and voter suppression negate any Democratic wave in 2018?
No.
I think
meaning you don't think it's an issue, or there will be enough of an impetus to overcome it?
Everyone talks on the right. It's all this kind of voter fraud stuff. It's extraordinarily hard to kind of conduct a coordinated voter fraud sort of effort. Voter suppression, again, very, very hard to kind of do a coordinated. Yes, it may, you know, impact a few people's decisions whether they vote or how they vote. Gerrymandering, we saw it in Virginia this past week that the Republicans gerrymandered the House of Delegates, and now it's basically it's 50-50 split in the House of Delegates. So even in wave elections, actually, in wave elections, gerrymandering actually works against the gerrymandered party, because the whole point of gerrymandering is to get as many seats as possible. So you start to stretch yourself a little bit thin in areas. So if you do get hit with a wave, you've essentially stretched out your own partisans so much so that there's not enough people there to really insulate yourself.
But I think a lot of people watching this do say that Democrats are underrepresented in the legislature because of the way the districts are drawn, and that's why I think you're seeing even Republicans like Arnold Schwarzenegger making a big effort.
I really do think that gerrymandering on the margin can make a difference.
On the margin, absolutely.
Yeah, on the margin.
Yeah.
You know, is it going to lead to wave one way or the other? Probably not.
Yeah.
But on the margin, yeah, it can in any given state house or in Congress make the difference of a few seats one way or the other. They could be critical seats, absolutely. But that's probably not the number one defining issue of what will determine what happens in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm back up to real time again.
Well, jumping on 2018, but focusing on California. Here in California, we definitely see the intra-party squabbles and strife, particularly in the race for the Senate seat currently held by Dianne Feinstein. Feinstein is being challenged by California State Senate Leader Kevin De Leon. Dan, what do you make of this contest? Does De Leon have a does he have a chance?
Oh, man, if he had a chance, he sure watched it slip away in a big time. He may get it back, but boy, the last couple of weeks with all the Me Too reaction in Sacramento and his role right in the center of it, his reaction in Sacramento to the whole Me Too situation was just pathetic.
Now, this involves sexual harassment.
The sexual harassment.
State Senate.
You know, I mean, there have been bills 2 years in a row working through the legislature for whistleblower protection that cleared the assembly, and both times they died on the suspense file in the Senate, which basically means that the head of the Appropriations Committee and the Senate President Pro Tem, Mr. De Leon, are calling the shots and bearing those bills. And that it had to do with whistleblower protection for legislative workers in the legislature who don't enjoy the same protections as almost everybody else in state government. When that starts, you know, now he's backpedaling, but I'm not sure that he can unwind this one. And he already started out with not very good name recognition, and the poll, you know, the poll that was out is before people start to even realize this. And he was already sort of, it's, you know, Feinstein was looking pretty good in just a head-to-head. So I think De Leon's got problems. That said, Dianne Feinstein's numbers in this poll are not exactly glowing for the sitting incumbent. She starts out with pretty poor favorable numbers for somebody going into a race. If it, when it becomes a three-way race with Steyer, she barely gets 49%. That's not the place you want to start as an incumbent.
Well, someone in the audience actually asked, should the Democrats run a new candidate for California Senate? Do you think Steyer is it?
You know, Carla? Tom Steyer, it's interesting. I think those impeachment ads he's got out are really effective in the sense that he's not a screamer in these ads. He's just looking at the camera saying, what has come of our country. It's an effective way to go at it. He's definitely upping his name recognition and his profile. He's on Sunday shows and a lot of the cable shows now. People are starting to know who he is. The question is, what is his end game? A lot of people have said he's just not pulled the trigger on running, and he's been talking about it for a long time. But remember, this is a guy who is worth $1.3 billion, I think it is. He could absolutely swamp Dianne Feinstein if he got into that race. But I still think, look, as a press person, I get now her every day her press releases, today two or three of them, and she is nailing the Trump administration. That was the criticism that she, at a Commonwealth Club event, it all came down to the Commonwealth Club, where she made the statement that she hopes President Trump could be a good president. She thinks that that with some help that it could happen. And she was just pilloried for that statement. Since then, she has, she's been very, very critical of him. And I think, in fairness, she always has been. And she's taken such a lead role on the Judiciary Committee, on the Intelligence Committee, that it is going to be very hard to Bigfoot that. Don't you think so, Carson?
The wild card here is, do the Republicans run someone? And if they do run someone, is it someone credible enough to at least coalesce the 30-ish percent of the Republican vote in the June primary that will then allow that individual to be the top two person?
In the top two.
So is it Feinstein versus a Republican, or is it Feinstein versus another Democrat? That's the wild card situation.
And depending on that, how do you see the does the outcome differ?
If it's Feinstein versus Republican, Feinstein can just she can go home. She can go on vacation. She doesn't have to do anything. She's winning that election, probably by 60%, like she did, the last time. So if it's Feinstein versus a Democrat, whether it's a De Leon, whether it's a Steyer, whether it's someone, I think a Bernie supporter actually has, Young Turk producer has jumped in recently. If it's any one of those individuals, it could shift rather dramatically against her, depending on who it might be. Steyer has the money, so he can instantly kind of get the name recognition, be able to compete on the advertising within this very expensive state. De Leon has the passion. He does have serious problems, and now very big problems, particularly because Tony Mendoza, the most recently accused state senator in Sacramento of sexual harassment, has been his housemate for quite some time. And as chair of the Rules Committee, De Leon knows that this accusation was brought against Mendoza and kind of been sitting on it for quite some time. So,
and the accusation is that Mendoza brought
an intern home with him.
Yeah. So,
there are problems there with De Leon.
Washing up
right
on
now.
Him in a way that.
I think Steyer's a more as a bigger. A bigger issue then for that reason to Feinstein then I don't see De Leon mobilizing and motivating anyone except the left wing of the party.
But the left wing is considerable. There is a Bernie-crat wing of the party, and he's already gotten some big endorsers. Ro Khanna being one of them, coming out and saying it's time for a new voice. Feinstein, her service should be appreciated, but we need new blood. There's a whole group, four of the
U.S. San Francisco supervisors.
That's four San Francisco supervisors.
The Bernie supporters really go in on a hedge fund manager?
Will
they really say, yes, he's my man, that former hedge fund manager is worth billions of dollars and who can't really talk about the issues really beyond climate change, and even then he's kind of
wait a minute. If we have top two, which we do in this state, and we get to the general election, and it's Feinstein, who's a centrist Democrat, versus De Leon, then you have the simple numbers, if you will, of the political spread. The Republicans have nowhere else to go but Feinstein if they vote. And that'll be the question.
Yeah. That's the question.
But she's done a good job of sort of keeping the Central Valley forces, if not alienating them, unlike most Democrats. Mm-hmm. Okay. Steyer is kind of more of a wild card because we really never, publicly, we're never quite sure where to place him yet on the spectrum. And he doesn't have a record behind him, a voting record, a political record that can be looked to. De Leon is pretty clear where he's been.
Oh, yeah.
And so I get it that we've seen enough rich guys come through the state.
And never
been successful. But De Leon strikes me, or I'm sorry, Steyer strikes me as being a more intriguing challenger to Feinstein in terms of the potential than De Leon.
Yeah, I think
does.
You could throw more money at it. Yeah. I'm also interested in watching the voices against Feinstein. I think in some ways there's a real ageist aspect to it. Just sweep her out the door. Wait a minute. There is, and as somebody said, 80's the new 50, I don't know if you can.
That's just our wishful thinking.
That's just my wishful thinking, right.
Now, this probably won't play a role in the U.S. Senate seat here, but what role in other state elections do you think the gas tax is going to play? There's some questioning on that in this new poll that we were looking at earlier. This, by the way, is a poll from
USC.
USC and
LA Times.
Yeah. Right. I think Californians are split on the gas tax in the sense of, I know we've seen some polls going both ways. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we all live in the Bay Area. How much time are we all spending in traffic here? People are like, enough already. Build those roads, fix the bridges. Let's get this done. I got to pay more for gas tax. But on the other hand, we've seen polls that suggest when people are asked, do you want to pay more for gas? They say no. I don't think he's exactly clear where.
I don't think it's exactly clear unless the question on ballot is exactly clear. And it
won't be.
Well, that's the question. That's for the courts to decide right now. And I think Becerra, the attorney general, is going to have some explaining to do, frankly, because he's tried to tip the scale. I think pretty clearly, and the And the district court, you know, the superior court has said no, no, no. Mm-hmm. And it's now up on appeal. But he basically tried to skew the question so there's no mention in it of the word tax, of what it really is. And look, whatever you think about the gas tax, you know, and it probably is a good idea, but whatever you think about it, I still believe there's something to be said for ballot integrity and honesty with the voters about what you're voting on. Mm-hmm. And when Becerra is basically trying to, come up with ballot wording that has nothing to, well, it doesn't have anything to do, but hides the most important thing, I think that's politically problematic, and I think he should be taken to task for it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I think ultimately it'll be very close, however it's worded and however it kind of gets onto the ballot. And I think it will get onto the ballot in some form or way.
Okay.
The money is going to be behind the keeping the gas tax.
Right.
You have business groups who are for it. They lobbied for it in Sacramento, so they're going to put money behind it. It stopped whatever referendum on it. You have labor who's going to be behind it. You have Jerry Brown who's going to be behind it. Plus, then of course, the entire Democratic establishment. So state Republicans don't really have much going for them financially. And again, ballot propositions are extraordinarily expensive. And as these polls really show, it depends on how you word it. And really, that comes also down to how are the commercials going to be talking about it? Is it going to be talking about the potholes and your commute times and the traffic? Or is it going to be talking about the tax and the increase?
Yeah, but you don't want to start a ballot measure with your opposition at 54%.
No.
That's basically, essentially, you're asking people to tax themselves. It's basically throwing the question in the electorate, although it's basically effectively in a referendum on what the legislature did. It's basically starting from scratch. And you don't want a tax measure starting at 54% and then having it being mired in this controversy about dishonesty from Becerra.
You can talk about the policy aspects of it, but from the political side, I was surprised that Jerry Brown and the legislative Democrats didn't at least some form or way assign the additional gas tax and all the fees into some sort of special fund that's dedicated to transportation issues. Right now, all that money just goes into the general fund. And so, yeah, of course, they're all saying this is for your roads, this is for transportation, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, politicians have sticky fingers, you know, and how they've yet to really prioritize transportation, even though the budget has increased by, what, $30, $40 billion over the last few years. You can't tell me that there hasn't been any money out of that $30, $40 billion to really kind of redirect toward transportation issues. So what happens 2, 3, 4, 10 years down the road once we have a new governor who has no attachment to this deal at all, once we have new legislative leaders who have no attachment to this deal, once we have new legislatures who have no attachment to this deal or this bill. So I think politically that hurt them. Now you can talk about the policy implications of creating too much special funds and how that really ties your hands from a budgeting perspective. But politically, I think that did.
There's another political wild card, if you will, in this whole thing too. Which has gotten lost in it all. The tax is 12 cents on the gallon, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And to put in a pitch for my brother, who does energy pricing research, it turns out that there's this 20 cents that we're constantly paying, that we're currently paying.
That's right.
That is totally unexplained why it's that high. It's not explained by our special blend. It's not explained by the production costs. But it looks like, and it's been going on for a couple of years at least now, that it looks like basically what's going on is that there's some inflating of the cost of gas that's far more, it turns out, than this 12 cents. Well, when people start to figure that out, mm-hmm. how that plays in this politically.
Because we are paying the highest gas.
We're paying the highest gas, and some of it you'd expect because we've got this special blend, we've got this special refining and distribution system.
Cap and trade.
But from an economist's point of view, it turns out there's about 20 cents that's totally unexplained, and the legislators and the governor don't seem to want to find out where it's been going. Well, it's going into this it's either going into the oil companies' pockets, the refiners or the sales. It's a mysterious 20 cents there. What's going on here?
Let's ask the audience. Raise your hand if you support the 12 cents tax and going to infrastructure. People listening, a pretty strong majority. Any opposed? A few folks.
If it goes to infrastructure.
That's a good question. How the question is asked. How many support it if it just goes into some unnamed general fund, my reelection campaign? You are my audience. Well, let's move on then. Let's talk about Alabama. So GOP Senate candidate Roy Moore, accused by five women of inappropriate contact with teenage girls, including making sexual advances on a 14-year-old, but now at least two, I guess, are on the record. So let's talk about the reaction from national Republicans and Alabama Republicans. I'll start by reminding folks that Roy Moore was not the choice of Senate Republicans in Washington, such as Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, nor of President Donald Trump, yet Moore won the primary. And we should also point out there are a wide array of conservatives and other Republicans who have been blasting Roy Moore, including party leaders, Mitt Romney, John Podhoretz, George Will, Charlie Sykes, and on and on and on. So,
and now Mitch McConnell.
And Mitch McConnell. Yeah. Well, my point being, I don't want to make it sound like we're tarring the entire party with this, but this is a pretty extraordinary thing when you have quite a number of Alabama state party leaders coming out and defending Roy Moore, and a fair number of responses we're seeing is, even if it's true, they'll support.
Right there. The party is tarred with that right there, because there's no reason for these women to come out. I mean, he's questioning, why would they come out after 40 years? There's no reason for them to come out except to tell the truth. The fact is that they and Breitbart is, for instance, I mean, and Steve Bannon is full on, in support of Roy Moore and has been. I saw him recently at the California Republican convention where he went on and on about how the media was out after Roy Moore because of the Ten Commandments. I mean,
in his defense, the Ten Commandments don't say anything about not dating teenagers. I mean, it's not. I've read it. I mean, it's not in there.
Yeah, I do love Roy Moore's justification that he asked permission of the mothers of all the girls that he went out with.
All
of them.
Yes.
All of them,
yeah. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I'm sorry. I mean, this is beyond belief. But this if it's true business is going to slime Republicans mm-hmm. everywhere in every race, because we as reporters are going to be saying, do you stand with this guy? I mean, at what point is there anything he could do that would not make you, want to stand with him? And that is what I think Republicans have got to hope that he pulls out of this race, because from here to eternity, they're going to be stuck with this in a very big way.
Or the Senate Republicans, if he were to win, and that's a big if, because the new polling does show the Democrat in Alabama winning.
Doug Jones.
Doug Jones. If he does win, the Senate Republicans definitely should do what Cory Gardner, senator from Colorado, who runs the National Senate Committee, the people who get senators elected. He said that we would vote to expel him from the Senate, which is rarely, if it has ever happened. I don't know any fact checker on that.
Do we know what would happen? Would there be another special election, or would the Alabama governor appoint Luther Strange again?
My understanding is it would take a two-thirds vote of the Senate to do that, and that is almost an impossible hurdle.
Who's going to vote not to do that?
I don't know.
The Democrats can't vote no at that point.
When you're watching these Republicans in Alabama come to his defense, or the videos of him coming into a hall and getting a standing ovation, You got to wonder what is going on with the Republican Party that outright the party isn't just distancing itself from him in every way. That is not happening in Alabama. And the questioning of these women who have come forward and didn't. The woman who came forward today, Gloria Allred, had a press conference with a woman who is a Trump supporter.
Oh, really? I didn't.
Yes. No. Both her and her husband voted for Trump. Moore's defense was, I don't even know this woman. Allred produced the high school yearbook in which he wrote to the young girl, you're just the sweetest and cutest girl I've ever seen. Love Roy Moore, DA. I mean, I don't know, the whole thing is so smarmy, it's I don't even know where to go on it. But I think it just shows, because we've heard nothing from President Trump on this, except I don't read a lot on it, I think is what he said. I don't
no
watch
surprise
TV,
there.
I think is what he said.
But
why isn't he, if he is the titular head of the party, mm-hmm. where is he on this?
Yeah, but you know, Carson, you know, when you say that the party, how could they not? I mean, I just rewind the tape 13 months, and we just sat there and we said, how could the nation?
That's yeah.
You know, and I'm sorry, but I'm with Carla. It that would be a pretty high threshold, because it would mean because of what's at stake for the Republicans, you know, and the risk. It cuts both ways, but mainly we have so inoculated ourselves to this sort of stuff. You know, I mean, if you told me after the Trump tapes came out 14 months ago that we would have been sitting here as we have been, you know, I did have questions that he could win, but, you know, I mean, I still...
But in that case, 17 women came out on the record,
yeah,
and accused him, and that did not matter.
I'm just saying that 99 senators are a lot different than the entire United Nations. They are a different subset of individuals, and Republicans would have enormous reason to vote en masse to expel him, because it would create an open seat in a state that is going to go red at some point, whether it's 3 years down the road if Doug Jones wins in the special election, or if it becomes open again through some other reason. And so, yeah, it would be to their political benefits. Plus, then it also shows that they are seriously pushing themselves away from this whole situation, that they don't want anything to do with him. Now, I'm not... that this by no means defending Roy Moore, but
if they didn't speak up with the candidate who said homosexuality should be illegal,
correct.
If they didn't speak up with when this candidate mm-hmm. said what transgender people should be jailed, all the crazy stuff that he said, you know.
Oh, he's been unfit for office,
yeah.
since day one,
and yet. Someone in the audience writes, an Alabama friend told me today that Roy Moore will be a shoe-in for governor. Agree. I mean, he's been elected. This is a man who already had been removed from office as a judge twice. Right? Was it once?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I believe
twice.
It was twice.
Twice.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was once.
Twice.
Okay, and then he got reelected back to the position. Yeah. Thank you.
Right. And to hear some of the excuses, people bending over backwards, trying to justify this behavior. This is just the latest in this. In this whole issue of sexual harassment, and it's been so interesting to watch what Harvey Weinstein hath wrought here. You know, from Hollywood to Sacramento to Alabama, it's open. The door is open.
That's really the question. And
you're seeing it across all state capitals. I mean, Minnesota, seen to see it everywhere.
But that's really sort of the interesting question is, have we, you know, was Harvey Weinstein different than Donald Trump was? And obviously the answer is yes in some way. And the question part is, why didn't it happen a year ago? But the other part of the question is, has it shifted permanently or not? And if it has shifted permanently since last year, then coming back to our earlier discussion, I think, Carson, you may be right. Mm-hmm. You know, and the question, and it's going to really it remains to be seen whether or not this shift that has that we've seen in the last 6 weeks or whenever the Weinstein thing broke, you know, has it really shifted it permanently? Or is in Alabama and among the Republican Party, when it's their own,
right,
are they willing to just sort of shake it off?
No, has this shifted permanently? What was the movie we saw here in California in 2003 when how many women came out about Arnold Schwarzenegger and made the very same accusations?
Right, yeah.
And he was elected the next week.
Right, yeah.
It didn't matter.
I don't know.
I think we're going to see this movie over and over again.
And what concerns me also, and to bring it back to California here, how De Leon, bring it back to De Leon, is now referring all of these sexual assault, sexual harassment accusations and not to the Rules Committee as it has been done, but now to an outside counsel.
So, yeah.
Which does that create client-attorney privilege? Which means that it's already impossible for reporters to get information out of the legislature right now.
Yeah.
Because of the Legislature Disclosure Act, which is very different from the Open Records Act.
Right.
So now if you create this client-attorney privilege, it's going to be impossible for any reporter to ever get a FOIA request.
I think what this has served to do in an interesting way is cast a light. It took sex to cast a light on the secrecy of what's going on in the legislature, mm-hmm. which has been a horrible problem to begin with for as long as I've been a reporter. But maybe that's the way that this issue is going to finally. That
the other big difference I think is
hit their head against the wall trying to get information.
Right.
Yeah.
The other big difference here is I think you're seeing women standing up with women here, and they are not going to let this go away. When you see people like Jackie Speier come forward, and people in all walks of life, like I don't know if any of you read the story that Diane and I had, their swimmer. Wrote about being molested by her coach as a little girl. I mean, women are now coming forward, and I think they are not going to take this stuff anymore. And you know, you're seeing every day another big executive today, a big venture capitalist from one of the major firms here, had to quit over sexual harassment. I just think that there are got to be a lot of people in power who are really sweating it out right now. And wondering if they're going to be exposed next.
What happens?
I think some of these women are not going to let this go. It's not going to go back into the closet.
What could happen is, I mean, Betty Yee, state controller, has massive auditing powers within her office. These settlements are taxpayer dollars, which then gives her every right and every power to go into and investigate this entire thing and create an audit on kind of what's happening in Sacramento. That's what really needs to happen. This outside counsel stuff, this pissing around, we're never going to get a true, real account of what's happening, not only with taxpayer dollars, but then what's happening, what has happened to these poor individuals.
If and Betty Yee really does that, that'll be a new day.
I would. That's,
okay.
Should,
I mean...
Betty, all around watching.
Call Betty Yee, state controller.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, let's, on that note, move on. Let's do a bit of a roundup of other things, Trump. So I think you mentioned earlier his trip to Asia. Someone in the audience says, aside from Trump calling North Korea's Kim Jong-un short and fat, and Trump being labeled an old man, what is our current relationship with North Korea?
Oh, God.
Let me put it this way. Has this trip, has he strengthened, weakened, or done nothing for our relationships with our allies there that we, of course, will be relying on with any confrontation with North Korea? South Korea, Japan, any help there, you think? Carla?
I mean, I just see this trip to me was... what you saw this trip mm-hmm. was the lights going out on the shining city on the hill when it came to hit the president of the United States hanging out with autocratic dictators, essentially. With the Philippine leader, Duterte, you know, singing a love song to Donald Trump, a guy who has been accused of killing 7,000 people in this country without any kind of legal. I mean, that to me is a mind blower. The meetings with Putin, and you know, I believe Putin. He says he didn't interfere in our election, so I believe him. And our intelligence people are political hacks. I don't, you know, I think at this point, what do you say about where is our standing as a moral voice anymore when we are told he brought up human rights issues with Putin and with Duterte by the White House, by Sarah Sanders, but there's no record because we weren't allowed as press people to watch or to witness this in any way. The press was completely shut out of these events, wasn't even allowed to tape record the president when he made the statements
to the press
yeah. In the press plane. That's unheard of in my experience. I'm just
and this is coming from someone who had run-ins with the Obama administration.
That's right, but I mean, you know, like, look, that kind of pullback in terms of the ability of the media to cover the president, we saw that. We saw his criticism of our own intelligence people on Veterans Day of all days, and his trying to walk a line with Putin, but basically saying he believes Putin over the FBI and 17 of our own intelligence agencies.
His future jailers.
Yeah.
Carson, your thought?
Whatever. I could go on and on.
What are your thoughts, Carson?
I think Carly, I mean, really summarized it quite well.
the one other thing I should say is, too, and this is another reason sort of the signing City on the Hill thing occurred to me is because it looks to me like China is emerging as the leader. You know, when it comes to trade, when it comes to leadership, particularly in the Asian realm, but I mean, we're seeing that on climate change, for instance, there's Jerry Brown over there running the show for the United States in Europe. How is our president leading on those issues? The TPP we pulled out of, and that left all those countries working with each other, and we're out in the cold there, as we're out in the cold in climate change.
And they're doing just fine without us.
And they're doing just fine without us. I don't know. I mean, I saw this trip as sort of a dramatization of our loss of stature, and our loss of kind of as a moral leader.
As a moral and as an economic leader.
Yeah.
And it's happening within such a short period of time. It's really pretty staggering.
Last Week to Week program, Carson was also on the panel, and this was right after Robert Mueller had issued the first indictments. The buzz lately around the investigation has focused on people like Mike Flynn, former National Security Advisor. Carson, I want to start with you. Who do you think will be the next person to be indicted? Mike Flynn, Donald Trump Jr.
Oh, man. I mean, if you had to put money on someone who's talked about, I mean, Flynn or at least Flynn's son possibly might be the ones pulled in. But it's as I said last time on Week to Week, it's Mueller is a very precise, thoughtful investigator. And it's really hard to kind of know where he's going because he follows the evidence and he will always follow the evidence. So what we're talking about in the press, it could be where the evidence is going, or it could be someplace completely different. And we just won't know that until the indictments come out and they progress forward. And I think they will progress forward. This will be kind of a trickle sort of situation.
I thought a fascinating story, which just came out right before this forum today, was in The Atlantic, talking about how Julia Ioffe, who is a very well-known investigative reporter, did a great job. That Donald Trump Jr. Absolutely was receiving from WikiLeaks during the campaign instructions in terms of how to coordinate the campaign, the messaging on the campaign, how to release tweets and when to release them. And WikiLeaks was suggesting that Julian Assange should be made ambassador to Australia. I mean, At one point, they even pinpointed how when WikiLeaks said to Donald Trump Jr., make sure your dad tweets our latest release here of John Podesta's emails. And 15 minutes later, Trump tweets that release. I think that story is incredibly damaging today. And that was after, of course, Pence, Donald Trump Jr., and Trump himself said that WikiLeaks connection is complete false news. And the evidence is there today in that Atlantic story.
Dan?
I think it's, I'm not going to pretend to be able to prognosticate who's going to get indicted next. But I think clearly Mueller's being very methodical, and I'm sure it will have a lot to do. It may have a lot to do with who has cooperated and who hasn't, who what information is. He's leveraging, it seems like, and it's what any good prosecutor would do. He's seeing who's willing to turn and talk to protect their butts, and if they're willing to do that, who they give him. So I think it may be a circuitous route to get there. It may not.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's move on to our final topic before the news quiz. And someone in the audience actually asks a question, which is a good lead-in, which is, we haven't heard much about the new budget. What programs are cut or affected by it? So by programs, you mean California is cut and affected by it. Let's talk about this. So congressional Republicans are now saying they could vote on their tax bill this week. I don't know if that's the House bill or the Senate bill.
It's the House.
There are some differing versions between the two. If passed, it would be a major overhaul of the tax system in this country. For the first time since Republican President Ronald Reagan and Democratic House member Dan Rostenkowski rewrote the tax code in 1986. So, Dan, what do we know about this GOP tax plan?
Either one of them, we know that there's an income redistribution. It's probably going to go in the wrong direction, if you will. And what we also know is it's based on an economic theory that hasn't really panned out in the past. What we kind of came to be known in the 80s as trickle-down economics. It hasn't proven itself to be terribly effective. To say the least. So, but what we do know is that a lot of big companies and a lot of wealthy people will get some pretty big share of these tax breaks. I've always been somebody who's actually really felt that we needed some sort of real tax reform, some sort of tax simplification. But this is a crazy way to go about it. And this is not the solution. I think most people, actually, if you would ask them, would like to see a more understandable, more simplistic tax system.
And less manipulatable.
Less manipulatable. Just take the mortgage deduction issue and whether to do away with it. The fact of the matter is that, in reality, if you looked at just the mortgage deduction on its face by itself, it's a fairly regressive deduction that benefits those who are able to afford to buy a house. It skews the markets. Sitting by itself, it's a pretty bad deduction. But if you stop and you think about how many people have invested in property based on what it's done to the market and planned their finances around it, unwinding it is pretty difficult without being fairly draconian to people who made pretty big investments, assuming it's going to be there. There's talk that, okay, we won't apply it to the current house. But, in the Bay Area, but then you talk
That's right.
about capping
yeah, yeah.
it.
Yeah.
But then you talk about capping in the Bay Area. It's sort of out of touch with the reality of the Bay Area housing market.
No, it's going to hammer the Bay Area because four out of the six top markets in the country where homes are over 500,000 are Marin County, San Francisco, San Mateo, and Santa Clara. Yeah. Four of them right here in the Bay Area, okay? And those counties down in Orange County, Orange County, those areas down there, Every one of those vulnerable Republicans we're talking about, over 70% of the homes are over $500,000 in value. So you're right. It's going to hammer.
So there's a policy problem in unwinding it. Because, you know, we frankly started with a bad policy, but unwinding it now, after everybody's placed their bets basically based on it, is really problematic. And then there's the political problem you just talked about, because what happens to those Republicans who are, you know, in the Clinton districts, if you will, who are also in districts where their natural supporters are going to get hammered. If you do away with this, you do away with SALT. You know, I mean, it's a problematic political and policy problem.
Just
to highlight one last point on the mortgage, to highlight how difficult it is, there was a bill in Sacramento sponsored by Democrats, because that's the only bills they're ever going to get really passed. and it didn't even make itself out of committee. And that was to get rid of the state mortgage deduction. Woof, yeah. Where am I going here? for second homes, which of course we know who owns a second home in California.
Talk about a regressive tax break. Yeah.
So that didn't even get out of committee, let alone a vote on it. So that just shows just how difficult that particular deduction is, even in a state like California.
Yeah.
SALT is an interesting situation. It's the deduction for sales taxes, state income taxes, property taxes. And in a state like California, we are a high tax, high spending state. You know, that's just the nature of the game here. Yeah. Sacramento Democrats are up in arms over this particular deduction because it really will kind of throw a hole into their house of cards when it comes to how they've managed the state budget for years. The personal income tax in the state of California, and this, if you talk to Jerry Brown, Betty Yee, John Chung, any state Democrat will say this just as I'm about to say it, is the most volatile boom and bust budgeting tool that we have in this state.
That's right.
It creates these massive roller coasters in state finances that make it impossible to really budget on a long-term basis, because we just have no clue where our revenues are going to be at a later point in time, which makes it really hard to then fund the operations that we all really care about, progressives or conservatives. How do we get here? Part of it is because we've essentially been subsidized by the federal policy in allowing us to deduct these taxes from individuals, which has then allowed individuals to really not really care too much about the fact that they are being taxed really, really, really progressively. If this goes away, as some of these proposals have suggested they're going to tamper with this, it puts a lot of pressure on Sacramento to really try to figure out, okay, now what do we do? Because now individuals are really being hit by the true tax burden that we have placed on them within the state. And they're going to start changing their behavior. That either means making less money or moving or trying to find other ways to hide their income, which then creates massive budgeting problems for the state of California.
Especially if they were trying to hide their income by buying real estate, which they can no longer deduct.
Exactly. They're being kind of hit from all angles. It really does kind of create a massive policy situation, not just for these politically vulnerable Republicans who sit in Clinton districts, particularly in Orange County, but then also for Sacramento Democrats, because now what do they do? Now they're being told by their constituencies, we have to keep on spending. Spending, but now the revenue is really kind of really being vulnerable.
And there's a legitimate argument for SALT, for the exemption, you know, the deduction, which is essentially without it, the money's being double taxed. Your income is being double taxed. That's the count. That's the argument for the deduction. And, you know, so this is a real policy conundrum, which if they do it, you're absolutely right, Carson. Mm-hmm. It's going to create, in Sacramento, one of the most sticky political problems, just as we're about to go into a gubernatorial election.
Yes.
Something fun to watch. Well, on that note, we're going to go to our news quiz. I'll ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. If you win, please sit on your hands and let someone else win for a change. Fran is going to deliver the chocolate prizes. So the first question... who took a tumble into a sand pit while playing golf with President Trump way in back?
Abe?
Yes, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Yeah, there's actually a video of him walking up those and tumbling back.
Glad I don't play golf.
Really?
A wax museum in Indonesia removed a statue of whom after people shared selfies of them smiling with this man? Adolf Hitler.
Oh, whoa, whoa.
In fact, the image behind Adolf Hitler was Auschwitz.
Oh.
So, yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's one of those things where you're like, you actually had to be told that was in bad taste. Reportedly fearing for his life, the prime minister, I guess the former prime minister of Lebanon, is staying in what country? Sir, way over there along the edge. Saudi Arabia, yes. What country's president said he killed someone when he was 16 years old? Ma'am in the green, way in back. Duterte, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. Oh,
makes sense.
Makes sense. Pope Francis has banned the sale of what in the Vatican as of the new year? Ma'am?
Cigarettes.
Cigarettes, that's right. A different kind of indulgence. Okay.
Banned cell phones.
What will the New York City subway system no longer call its riders? So in their PA announcements, they'll no longer refer to their riders as what? Ma'am, I think you're... Sorry?
Ladies
and gentlemen. Yes, they...
passengers.
Hey, you. You rabble. Next question. What famed 94-year-old gossip columnist just passed away? Sir, I saw your hand. Liz Smith of New York. That is correct. Chanting, quote, Europe must be white, unquote, and quote, pray for an Islamic Holocaust, unquote, 60,000 nationalists marched in what European country? In your Poland, that is correct. Okay, almost done.
We got a happy group of questions.
Okay, let's...
Yeah, really?
This is happy news, okay? You'll like this. In Indianapolis, two women climbed through a McDonald's drive-through window and threw punches at the store manager over a disagreement about what? Ma'am in the purple? Their Chicken McNuggets order. That is correct. Hey, you have to have priorities when it comes to ordering food. Okay, this is a bit of a long one, but it's worth it. Earlier this year, he was called racist for saying that African Americans were coming to his state to sell drugs and, quote, impregnate white girls, unquote. This weekend, in response to protest having been called a racist for those remarks, he said, quote, you shoot at the enemy. You try to identify the enemy, and the enemy right now, the overwhelming majority of people coming in, are people of color or people of Hispanic origin, unquote. Who is this governor? Mm-hmm. Way in back there, ma'am.
LePage, Maine.
LePage of Maine, that's correct.
Oh,
yes.
God.
He was Trump before Trump. Do we have another one in there? Okay, one more, and you want a happy one, so...
Hey, it's,
whoa.
So.
You're on a roll. You're on a roll. Go for it.
There's not a lot of happy news out there, folks, okay?
No happy ones.
Okay, this makes at least one person happy in New Jersey. The jury said it was deadlocked in its deliberations over the bribery trial against what U.S. senator? Ma'am along the side there? Bob Menendez of New Jersey, a Democrat. See, we have good news and bad news for both parties. Listen, we'll have a lot more news quiz questions. I'll try to make some of them happy. On Monday, November 27th, right here at the Commonwealth Club, you can find our week-to-week news quiz every week on our website. Thanks to our great panel today, Carla Marinucci, Carson Bruno, Dan Borenstein. Thanks to all of you for coming tonight. Thanks to everyone listening and watching online. Have a great week.